You had mentioned that you had done some research and found a whole bunch of interesting sound technologies that were going on that were unaware of each other.
Yeah, you know, I've been publicizing the book as a vehicle to change the culture's attitude towards sound. And, you know, there are people in the medical community that are doing work, people in the entertainment community, the classroom acoustics. There's a classic people called soundscape music. They're just all over the place, and they're sort of coming out of the woodwork. There are the people who are studying cultures that are ignoring sound. There's a group of acoustic archaeologists that are trying to interpret artifacts from older cultures in terms of their acoustic properties. The theater people are certainly interested. The cinema, they use sound very creatively, and they don't necessarily aim for realism. For them, sound and aural space is just another artistic tool to the end of the goal of their creation. And I mean, the list is very long. In fact, in the beginning of the book, I list about 25 disciplines, all of which have something to say about aural space.
And you want to change people's attitudes about sound in the way of making them aware of the effects on their lives, or in another way?
Well, I have a personal view that all the uses of hearing, the one we ignore most is what I call social cohesion, the ability to connect to people and events in the environment. Appreciation of being connected to what's going around you. So in an odd way, while we've globalized everything and the internet makes us one big village, we tend to live isolated existences, and that isolation is carried over to sound. We shut ourselves off from everything. I think we lose something.
Are you saying we're walking around in a fog?
We're walking around disconnected, because if you think about it, if you lived in a small room that was sound and light impervious, you'd be completely isolated from everything going on in humanity. You'd be disconnected. So I think the issue of sound is really an issue of connection. Who do you want to be connected to? What do you want to be connected to? And when and for what reason? And even in a simple case of driving a very upscale car with lots of sound isolation and sound absorption, you're isolated from the truck coming into your blind spot as you're driving along. You just can't hear him.
Mm-hmm.
And you really want to be isolated from the events that are taking place on the road. I suspect you don't really want to be isolated from it.
So you think this less sensitivity to sound is making us less sensitive towards other people?
I think it's sort of partially the flip side, because we started to treasure isolation. And part of it, if you think about it, if you lived on an Iowa farm in the turn of the century, the amount of simulation you experienced was minimal. And even a traveling salesman that came to visit you was bringing stories. Yes, he was coming to sell you pots and pans, but it was a social connection that you welcomed. The rest of the day, you know, you had a family members and cows. Think about a modern person. They're inundated every time they connect to anything. Everybody wants to come in with messages, mostly commercial. And so what we ended up creating is what I call the gatekeeper function. The inundation is so massive that we regulate what we're willing to allow in, and we've gone in the direction of letting less and less in, so you end up throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Yes, you suppress all these obnoxious messages, but you also suppress, you know, simple life communication.
Well, there's no effective way to filter, is there?
Well, you can be more creative. I mean, you can not have a radio and television in your home and be connected to your kids. That's not necessarily intrusive.
That's not intrusive, but that's not necessarily practical.
Oh, it's quite practical. I mean, in our house, we have, in all the first floor commons rooms, we have no doors. Anybody in the first floor of our house is orally connected to everybody else. Not in a loud way, but, you know, you can be aware of what else is going on in the space. It's a choice.
Well, definitely. But in today's world, you have a certain amount of information that more or less is required to live. You want to hear what the weather forecast is. I mean, you don't have to. I mean, you can just stick your hand out and take a guess.
But well, you can selectively allow certain things in, which is what you do when you sit down on the computer and read your email and you have your spam filters. Yes, you have to be selective as to what you let in. But to some extent, you can let more in certain situations. You know, if you're in the summer, you can open your windows and be connected to the birds and maybe the kids playing outside. You don't have to be cut off from everything.
No, that's quite true. Well, I wonder if opening our ears will make us gentler people and enjoy those around us more.
It might. I mean, for me it works. I don't know for whom else it would work. You can try it. And they used to try these funny little things. There are a whole bunch of groups. There's the World Acoustic Ecology Group. And one of the things they recommended, in fact, I think they did this experiment, try walking around the city with a friend blindfolded and just listening to the city. You know, just try spending an hour listening without being, you know, overpowered by the visual experience.
Yeah, that might be very interesting.
In fact, there's another group that had an interview online where they recommend when you visit a place, you know, spend a few minutes just listening. You know, sit in the piazza, close your eyes, and spend 10 minutes just listening to what's happening about you. You know, it's not a lot of work. It's just a different way of experiencing life.
Well, I know it. When I take my daughter to the zoo, there are certain exhibits that you have to stand and watch for about 5 minutes till you absorb what's really there and you see the animals and hear the sounds and really get into the environment. And if you just walk there and look, you're missing 90% of what's there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But these are choices. In fact, one of the other groups that I studied was called sensory anthropology. And every culture has their own attitude toward the senses, what's important, what they're used for. And our culture tends to label the senses based on physical stimulus. Ears are for acoustic waves and eyes are for light. Other groups organize sensory experiences completely differently. There's one tribe that organized, they had two senses in their vocabulary. They had vision, which was the purpose of navigating and not walking into trees. And they had experiencing life, which was all the other senses. And that's how they divided it. For them, vision was simply avoiding trees and cliffs.
Well, how you categorize senses is definitely determined on base where you live and what threats you have during your normal day.
It's also cultural. It's not that they're not using all their senses. It's just how they label them and what they think they're good for. Prior to literacy and industrialization, most cultures that I've been able to find evidence of treated sounds as probably the most important sense. It's a sensory system that works at long distances. It works at night. It works even when there are obstacles in the way. You can hear, you get information about the interior state of either an elephant or a tree. And for them, hearing was the important sensory mode. I mean, the eyes were important too. Ears were right up there at the top.
Well, and if you discount and remove reading from the equation, ears become a lot more important.
Yeah. But even from an information point of view, reading never communicates the intonation, the emotional state. Reading is rather stripped of all kinds of important information. You know, the linguistics is not stripped, but everything else is stripped. But people, again, even in dialogues, they misunderstand the importance of these secondary attributes. There was one researcher that went to a major university and discovered that even in a major university, something like 70% of all verbal communications were basically gossip in the service of group connection and, you know, emotional touchy-feely without content. And if you were to transcribe those dialogues, you would strip out all the information that was really taking place, which was all the emotional mood, affect, group belongingness, and so forth. It was a form of grooming. In fact, he called it verbal grooming.
That's very interesting. And when you compare also that to Todd Risley's research about children from birth until 3 years old, that had a certain amount of information that they heard, which were managing what was going on. Don't stick your finger in your ear, don't do this, move there. And then there was the broader sense of language where the child developed beyond this and developed greater vocabulary. And the folks who didn't speak the broader sense raised children with limited vocabulary and limited IQs.
Yeah, but even if you get a very educated person, there's whole kinds of emotions. I mean, if you look at the vocabulary for emotions, they're very difficult to communicate in a linguistic sense. You want it to describe your mood. You need a lot of skill as a writer to communicate your emotional state. You talk to somebody in your family, you spend 2 minutes, and they can read your emotional state just from all the subtle cues without you ever being able to explain where you're going.
Tone and intonation.
Tone, intonation, where you put the pauses, the stress. I mean, there's just so much material in there, which is often not studied because it's not really amenable to the scientific paradigms that the linguists like. And so people do study it, but to much lesser degree, simply because it's very hard to study something you can't put into words and numbers. But that doesn't mean it isn't important.
So you're saying because it can't be quantified, people don't study it as much?
Yeah, and because one of the rules of science is supposed to be reproducibility and quantifiability. If you take those away, then they say, well, it's not science. That doesn't mean it isn't important, but it may not fit the scientific model.
Well, maybe we have to change the scientific model.
maybe. And there are movements afoot, which sort of was strong in the 19th century, dealing with phenomena as phenomenology, not in terms of the scientific paradigm. And that's where I came down when I got all finished with the book. I said, you know, science in the lab is so you can understand a phenomenon that you already have experienced and observed and know is real. So you go out and do your field work to find the phenomenon, to live with it, and then you may want to go back into the laboratory to explore pieces of it. But you don't discover phenomena in the lab. That's not the point of science, is to take something apart into pieces and the relationship of its pieces. But you first have to know what it is, and how do you know what the phenomenon is that you're looking at.
So get out and look and hear.
Yeah, and I had a bunch of quotations in the book. One biologist had gone to some island in the Pacific and studied the fishermen there, and he said, you know, I don't remember the exact time, but in 6 weeks working with the fishermen, he learned more about fish biology than he would have in 2 years in the lab.
Hmm. Another message there. Go to the source, right?
Go join life and be part of it to see what's going on. You may not be able to prove what your intuitions are or your speculations, but at least get a gut feeling for the phenomena before you try studying it. That's my view. In one sense, the book on oral architecture is secondary to it. Really was an opportunity for me to do a case study to apply all the sort of principles I've been talking about. It's a phenomenology book. It's written partially in the first person. It's looking for phenomenon. It's recognizing that there may be, you know, insights that can't be proved. It's building off of what is known, but filling in the blanks. And it's a wonderful, I had a great time doing it because it was such an exquisite case study on everything I believe.
And there's nothing better than doing what you believe and enjoying it.
Absolutely. It was a gas. And curiously enough, there seems to be a resonance. I mean, the book has had legs, I think in part because it really takes a fresh look at a phenomenon, in this case a particular one, but it drops a lot of the cultural rigidity that we've come to associate with intellectual activities.
I think the book has legs because people enjoy reading something that is authored by somebody who is creative, innovative, and thinks out of the box and comes to something with a new approach that people can resonate with.
Well, thank you very much. I hope that's shared by my readers.